Sometime between 65 and 80,000 years ago, the sun was setting over the horizon, casting a warm orange glow over the sandy beaches of Sunda, or modern-day Southeast Asia. The waves lapped gently against the shore as a group of people scurried about, setting up their camp for the night. They had spent the day fishing in the nearby waters, and now it was time to cook their catch of fresh fish, dugong, and shellfish. One of the people began building a fire using dry twigs, leaves, and branches collected from the nearby forest. Once it was arranged in a way that would allow the air to flow freely and feed the fire, they pressed a long, thin piece of wood against a thicker, flat piece and began swiftly and expertly spinning it back and forwards between their hands. After just a few short moments, the bottom piece began to smolder, and they turned it over to drop the ember into a shredded piece of coconut tuft. Blowing gently and rhythmically, smoke began to billow out of the dry material before it suddenly burst into flames. The other members of the group began preparing their catch, cleaning and gutting the fish with long obsidian blades, butchering the dugong with hafted axes, and cracking open the shellfish with hammer stones so that the soft meat inside could be easily accessed. Once gutted and cleaned, they placed their bounty over the fire, turning them every so often to ensure they cooked evenly, and as the aroma of the meat filled the air, everyone's mouths began to water. Meanwhile, the children of the group played in the sand, built castles, and chased each other into the waves. But as the aroma made its way down the beach, the children knew it was time. They joined their parents, siblings, uncles and aunts, and grandmothers and grandfathers by the fire and began tearing off chunks of tender flesh with their hands. The night was cool and crisp, about 5 degrees colder than our average modern temperatures, but they sat comfortably around the fire, their faces flickering in the warm glow as they watched the stars come out, shared stories, laughed, and enjoyed each other's company. As the children began to drift off, they spoke gradually softer, and the sound of their voices mixed with the sound of the waves to create a peaceful lullaby that spoke to them through the thousands of generations who had done the same before. Only this group was different. They couldn't know it at the time, but they were about to achieve something that no other human had ever done before them. When they had arrived on the beach earlier that day, they had noticed birds flying out east across the ocean. They knew from their past experiences that these kinds of birds were not seabirds, and in fact were not even coastal birds, but these were birds that lived inland among the trees and shrubs that provided them with shelter and nourishment. This could only mean one thing to these people. Somewhere in the distance, there was new land. What they had no way of knowing was that the journey they were about to embark on would be the first time in human history that a new continent would be populated by seafaring people. They had no way of knowing that this new land would be one of the most unique and challenging landscapes on the planet, or that they would become the ancestors to one of the oldest continuous cultures on Earth. This is the archaeological story of how people came to Australia, what it was like, and how we know when and how it happened. My name is Zane, and this is Unearthing History. Before we begin, I'd like to point out that the introduction is a fictional recount of one possible scenario of how Australia was populated. We don't know for sure, and we probably will never have this level of detail about the ancient past, but I think it's important to understand that the people who made this journey were human, just like us, and I think that this is a great way to establish that connection. I would also like to acknowledge that Aboriginal people from all over the continent have different beliefs and stories of how life began in Australia. The information I'm providing here is just one perspective, it's a scientific perspective, and it's intended to be supplemental to these stories and is in no way supposed to discredit, erode, or disregard the perspectives and beliefs of Aboriginal people. And finally, this is not intended to be a complete history of the archaeology of Australia. Something of that scope would be an enormous undertaking and would take years to put together. People have literally spent years putting it together in books. For example, I could spend hours here solely focused on the climate changes that have occurred over the last 60,000 years that impact people's movements and are related to the archaeology without ever actually getting to the archaeology. Instead, this is presented as an introduction in the hope that it will spark an interest in Australia's ancient and wonderful cultures. In Australia, it is customary to perform an acknowledgement of country whenever somebody gives a speech or gathers for an event, and so I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which this was recorded, the Whadjuk Noongar people. I pay my respects to both them and all Aboriginal people in Australia, elders, past, present, and emerging. Let's begin. When people first came to Australia, it was very different. The Earth was cooler, and because of this, much of the water was locked away in glaciers and ice caps. This meant that the oceans were about 122 meters or 400 feet lower than they are today. This looked different all over the world, but in Australia, where the continental shelf is very shallow, Australia was about 30% larger than it is today. In the northwest of Australia, where there is now ocean separating the Northern Territory and the northern tip of Queensland, there was a lake larger than any other the continent has ever seen. This region was also entirely connected by land to Papua New Guinea and the Torres Strait. In the south, Tasmania was connected to Australia, and in the middle of what is now ocean separating Tasmania from the mainland was another huge lake. Overall, Australia had an additional 7.7 million square kilometers or 4.7 million square miles of additional land, and it looked so different during this time that we give it another name. We call it Sahul. Sahul was a cooler place than it is now, with temperatures averaging around 5 degrees below modern times. And because of this, the continent was wetter and had more forest and grasslands than it does today. The extent of these forests and grasslands fluctuated through time as the polar ice caps got bigger and smaller. As they expanded, Sahul became cooler and drier, causing the grasslands and forests to recede and be replaced with semi-arid plains. As the ice caps shrank, the temperatures became warmer and rainfall increased, causing the grasslands and forests to expand. At this time, Sahul was also home to a variety of animals known as Australian megafauna. These animals varied in size, but as their name suggests, were typically very large and weighed over 100 kilos or 220 pounds. One such example, and a personal favourite of mine, is the Diprotodon. This was the largest marsupial to ever exist at 3 metres or 10 feet long, 2 metres or 7 feet tall, and weighing up to 2,780 kilos or 6,130 pounds. This thing was enormous, and it looked like a rhino-sized wombat. Much less adorable examples include Thylacoleo carnifex, which was the largest carnivorous mammal to have ever lived in Australia and was about the same size as a female lion, and Megalania, which was a giant lizard with a maximum length of 7 metres or 23 feet and weighed up to 1,940 kilos or 4,277 pounds. As a point of reference, the largest living lizard on Earth right now is the Komodo dragon, and these typically weigh around 154 pounds or just 70 kilos. The largest kangaroos ever also existed during this time and stood up to 2 meters or 6 foot 6 tall and weighed up to 240 kilos or 530 pounds. Some of these animals have made it to modern times, for example the red and grey kangaroos, goanna lizards and saltwater crocodiles, but they've typically become much smaller and branched into slightly different species in the process, which is why we consider them megafauna and not just big versions of what we have today. The topic of why megafauna went extinct both here in Australia and the rest of the world is highly contested. It has been argued in Australia that the megafauna went extinct 46,000 years ago, approximately all at the same time, and that the main cause was human hunting. Other researchers have pointed to the fact that 50 of the known 88 megafaunal species in Sahul went extinct before 130,000 years ago, and that there's only firm evidence that 14 of them existed in Sahul when people arrived. Despite historic claims that hunting caused megafaunal extinctions, the first and only direct evidence of hunting was published in 2016. This study cited fragmented shells of an extinct megafaunal bird called Genyornis newtoni, which researchers argued had scorch marks consistent with cooking on them. The latest date we have for the Australian megafauna comes from a Zygomatorus, which is a species of Diprotodon that was recovered from Willandra Lakes in New South Wales and has a date of 33 to 37,000 years ago. This means that at least some of the megafauna survived for up to 30,000 years alongside humans. Okay, I think that's enough about Sahul. The cliff notes are that it was much bigger, relatively cooler, with more grasslands, rainfall, and forests than today, and there were a lot of really, really big animals. Let's take a break and go back to the people and the beaches of Asia for a moment. As I mentioned earlier, Australia looked so different during this time that we refer to it as Sahul. And this is also true for what is modern-day Southeast Asia, which was all largely connected by land, with the exception of some of the Indonesian and Philippines islands. Because of this, we call this region Sunda. And that's where we left off in our story. In order for people to cross from Sunda to Sahul, they had to navigate at least 80 kilometers or 50 miles of open ocean. We know this because separating Sunda and Sahul is the Wallace Trench or the Lombok Strait, which has a minimum depth of 250 meters or 820 feet. Today, the shortest crossing is 20 kilometers or 12.5 miles in the south and 40 kilometers or 25 miles wide in the north. Based on what we know about lower sea levels 65,000 years ago, we know that the Wallace Trench is deep enough that it never connected these two regions by land despite lower sea levels, and that the shortest crossing of open water would have been 80 kilometers or 50 miles when people came to Sahul. Now, this might not sound like a tremendous distance by modern standards, but according to various websites, the average speed of a canoe moving across a flat, windless lake is 6 kilometers or 3.7 miles per hour. If the wind picks up, the speed can be as much as halved, and if the waters are rough, even slower. It's possible that these people used wind-powered crafts, but we just don't have any evidence for it. So, for this thought experiment, let's say that the people travelled in a tandem canoe, which would have allowed one person to take a break while the other continues paddling, and vice versa. To allow for changes in wind speed and direction, currents, swell, and physical exhaustion, let's say they paddled at an average of 3 kilometres or 1.5 miles per hour. This would mean that we're looking at a journey of 26 hours and 40 minutes, assuming you know how to navigate a perfect and direct route across the open ocean towards a landmass that you've never even seen before. Now, I don't know if you've paddled in a canoe on the open ocean, but it's extremely physically demanding, and it would be my guess that this probably took far longer. But even still, let's assume 27 hours. 27 hours of non-stop paddling into the open ocean towards an unknown destination is an absolutely terrifying prospect. And yet that's exactly how people made it to Sahul, or some similar version, and we know this because we know what the climate was like at the time, including the sea levels, and we know that they did in fact make it here, since, you know, they're here. But how do we know when this happened? Why are we so sure that this happened 65,000 years ago? Well, this is a pretty easy question to answer, but there's one small problem. At the end of the Pleistocene, which is a geological epoch that started 2.5 million years ago and ended 11,700 years ago, the sea level rose about 120 meters. As I mentioned, in Australia, the continental shelf is quite shallow, and this led to the submerging of 30% of the land. What this means for us as archaeologists searching for the oldest sites to figure out when people first got here is that they're now underwater. Deep underwater. Well, kinda. You see, the Timor Sea, which runs across Australia's northwest coast, is on average only 200 meters or 656 feet deep, which is pretty shallow when it comes to the ocean. But these kinds of depths present enormous challenges to archaeology. For context, the deepest a human has ever gone without their equipment was achieved by Herbert Nitsch in 2007, who made it to 253.2 meters or 830 feet. However, he sustained a brain injury on the way back to the surface. The deepest anyone has dived with special equipment was 332 meters or 1,089 feet in 2014 by Ahmed Garba. But these dives were one-off and typically very fast. For example, Ahmed's descent only took 12 minutes and he immediately began to ascend, which took him 15 hours in order to avoid decompression sickness. To do archaeology at a depth of 200 meters or 656 feet, which is what we would require on the coast of Australia, mechanical submersibles would need to be used. The problem is that mechanical submersibles just don't have the capacity to perform the sensitive tasks associated with this type of investigation yet. I know that this is a problem that engineers could solve, but without funding and without a lot of funding, this is still a long way off. Anyway, the point is that any site we find on current land, no matter how close to the coast, is never going to be the oldest because those are underwater. However, the older sites on land can tell us about a bare minimum date for the first occupation of Australia. Majid Bibi is a sandstone rock shelter located in Arnhem Land at the far north tip of the Northern Territory. Arnhem Land is a remote and rugged region with a rich and vibrant indigenous culture. The landscape is dotted with rocky outcroppings, rolling hills, and pristine beaches that extend for miles. This is the home of the Yolngu people. The Yolngu people are made up of 13 different groups, and each of them have a rich oral tradition passed down through generations that tells stories of their creation ancestors and the spirits that inhabit the land. They are skilled hunters, fishers, and artists who have developed a deep understanding of their environment and its resources, and the Yolngu continue to live in this beautiful, rugged, and mysterious land where ancient and modern worlds intersect. It is here that the Marar people, one of the groups who make up the Yolngu, first showed archaeologist Johan Kaminga to this ancient rock shelter in 1970. Majid Bibi Rock Shelter sits in a lush tropical landscape surrounded by dense forests, rolling hills, and sparkling rivers. This area in particular is known for its rugged beauty and diverse wildlife, including exotic birds, marsupials, and reptiles. Majid Bibi Rock Shelter is nestled into the northwest face of a large sandstone mountain known as Jawumba and provides a natural refuge from the elements and a vantage point that looks out over the Magila floodplains. While the entire shelter is approximately 50 meters or 164 feet long, there is only a 5 meter or 16.5 foot area between the back wall and the roof that would be protected from the rain and the sunshine. The walls of the shelter are adorned with ancient rock art depicting the stories and beliefs of the indigenous people who once lived here. Among these images, you'll also find contact art which depicts guns, ships, wagons, and Europeans. The Marar people first led archaeologists to Majid Bibi in the early 1970s as part of a survey of alligator rivers. One of the archaeologists working on the project, Johan Kaminga, saw that the rock shelter had a deep deposit and hundreds of rock art panels, which led him to believe that this could be a perfect site to excavate. 3 years later, Kaminga returned to Majid Bibi and conducted a small-scale test pit excavation to a depth of 2.5 meters or 8.2 feet below the surface along the back wall. Kaminga unearthed a shell midden in the top 60 centimeters or 23 inches, which for those unaware is essentially a thick and compact layer of shellfish remains from humans eating the meat inside and discarding the shells. Within the midden, Kaminga found human and faunal remains and numerous stone artifacts including points. The types of animal and shellfish remains found in this layer include marsupial, reptile, bird, crustacean, and mollusk. Beneath the layer of shellfish, Kaminga uncovered a brownish-yellow sandy deposit that contained mostly quartz artifacts. At the bottom of the trench, they recovered several grinding stones and a large mortar and corresponding cup-shaped ground rock. Unfortunately, only a single carbon-14 date was done during this excavation, and that date has been criticized heavily for being an extremely small sample and also being collected over a large area. For context, if we take charcoal from one point, then 5 centimeters lower we take another bit, then 5 centimeters lower we take another bit, and then we put all of that charcoal together in a bag and then measure it, the date we get from that charcoal is going to apply to the entire 15 centimeter depth from which it was collected, and 15 centimeters can be thousands and thousands of years sometimes. This is also true if we do the same horizontally, because the soils and the sands don't always form flat. For this reason, modern collections are done from very specific points that are plotted into a graph so that we know exactly what region that date represents. Anyway, this particular sample gave Kaminga a date of 18,000 years before present. Feeling that more could be done at the site after there were advances in dating techniques, Rhys Jones, Richard Roberts, and Christopher Chippendale returned to Majid Bibi in 1988 and augured a single core which suggested that there could be artifacts present in the deposit as old or older than 50,000 years. This was an extremely exciting date for the time and would make it by far the oldest site in Australia if this was confirmed. Even by today's standards, this is a really, really old site, so in 1989, Rhys Jones returned once again to conduct a proper excavation of Majid Bibi. Jones placed a 1.5 by 1 meter or 5 by 3 foot trench right next to Kaminga's original 1973 pit so that the results could be compared directly. This dig returned similar results in cultural material as the original, although no human remains were found this time and the excavation ceased at 2.8 or 8.5 feet below the surface. The main concern for this dig, though, was to date the earliest occupation of the site. Jones took 11 thermoluminescence samples, and the lowest layer that had cultural material in it provided a date of 55,550 years ago, with an error range of 8,200 years. This was a huge deal at the time for both Aboriginal people and archaeologists all over the world. For Aboriginal people, it validated their stories and claims of having been in Australia practically forever. But for the scientific community, this seemed to conflict with the wealth of evidence that supported humans having only left Africa 100 to 90,000 years ago. In fact, even today you can still find maps with timelines of human migration out of Africa that don't line up with the dates from Majid Bibi, as well as other places like in North America. Anyway, archaeologists were faced with a problem. There was a large body of evidence to support the out-of-Africa theory that humans left Africa around 100,000 years ago, but this site in the northern tip of Australia showed that humans had been here for at least 55,000 years. This was no easy problem to solve, because at the time there were also no very old sites in Southeast Asia. If people had come down to Australia through Southeast Asia 50,000 years ago, then there should be some really old sites in Southeast Asia. And at the time, there weren't. But you'll be pleased to know that we've since found many old sites in Southeast Asia. For example, last year, a 30,000-year-old successful amputation was documented on the island of Borneo. We've also since uncovered rock art in Sulawesi, Indonesia, that's been dated to at least 45,000 years old. But for the archaeologists working in the 80s and 90s, the answer to their problem seemed like the most obvious one. The team had made a mistake, or misinterpreted the data. Researchers pointed to the fact that the carbon-14 and the thermoluminescence dates were increasingly different the further below the surface the team went. Usually these dates should line up, argued the researchers, and so this was an indication that perhaps the dates were incorrect. Other arguments included misinterpretation of the geological data that measured how fast the sediments built up over time, that the team had even used an auger hole to obtain dates in the first place, and that some of the artifacts may have been pushed downwards into the sand when people walked over them, thus making them seem deeper and older than they actually were. Despite what appears to be a fairly robust reply to these criticisms and the dates having a confidence interval of 95.6%, archaeologists remained skeptical of the 55,000-year-old date and tended to mostly converge around the site being somewhere between 35 and 45,000 years old. And that's pretty much where it stayed for the next 30 years. But while archaeologists worked with Aboriginal people all over the country, documenting sites that pushed back the earliest occupation dates of the continent elsewhere, the question of Majid Bibi hung over the Australian archaeological community like a haunting spectre. But in 2012, following another round of advances in dating, excavation, and general archaeological techniques and methods, Chris Clarkson and his team, led by the Gunditj Mi Aboriginal Corporation, set off to Majid Bibi to see if they could finally crack the code and put a definitive date on the earliest occupation of Majid Bibi. It would take the team two seasons, the first in 2012 and another in 2015. One of the most important parts of this dig was the strength of the partnership between the archaeologists and the Mara people working at and overseeing the excavations. The partnership gave the Mara people total and complete control over both the excavation and the recovered artifacts because, after all, it's their heritage being investigated, and this is a great example of how Western science and traditional knowledge can come together to produce something incredible. For example, the Mara people provided invaluable information about the origins of materials and the specific uses of tools to the archaeological team, and the agreement probably saved the dig from being completely shut down when human remains were found very early on. David Vardavilu, who is a lawyer representing the Gunditj Mi Aboriginal Corporation, said that, and I quote, "The Aboriginal community wanted things stopped, and the agreement allowed them to enter into discussion from a position of control. If there had been no agreement, I would hazard a guess that the community would have shut the dig down, but because the agreement was so robust, because they knew they could control what was done with everything that was removed, how it was going to be removed, how it was going to be stored, they were then cautiously happy for the dig to proceed." The results from this dig were published in 2015 in Nature, and I'll provide a link to it in the show notes. It also covers the previous digs as well if you're interested in that information. Clarkson and his team excavated to a depth of 2.6 meters below the surface and uncovered more than 11,000 artifacts. These included stone artifacts, ochre and paint, the oldest ground edge hafted stone axe in the world by about 20,000 years, and the oldest seed grinding tools ever found in Australia. For context, finds of this type from this time period are extremely rare for anywhere on Earth, let alone Australia. Richard Fulliger, who was a co-author of the paper and a world-renowned stone tool use wear and residue expert, said that, quote, "What we found was it's not just one kind of hatchet head we've got, but four or five quite different kinds. There's a huge variety of these things spread over thousands of years. In some ways, there are strong similarities with what happens at the very beginning, but there are also remarkable changes," end quote. Further analysis of grindstones from the site by Elspeth Hayes and her colleagues, who used use wear and residue analysis to determine how the artifacts were used, showed that people were processing water lilies, kapok bushes, roots, yams, and animal tissue at the site as far back as 8,320 years ago. But analysis of this type on the older artifacts is yet to be completed. Now, one of the biggest criticisms of the previous excavations was the question of integrity with regard to the sediments. Had the sand been mixed up over thousands of years, making the dates inaccurate? To try and address this issue, Clarkson and his team conducted what's called a Bayesian analysis. Bayesian analysis is a statistical test that answers research questions about the unknown based on probability formed using what is known. This is a test that is applied to pretty much every field, including social sciences, genetics, medicine, artificial intelligence, and more. It's reliable, it's been tested, and we know it works. This analysis argued that the sediments are indeed intact, that they haven't been mixed at all, and that the dates are reliable. Further evidence that the artifacts haven't moved and that the soil layers are reliable is that artifacts laying next to each other were able to be put back together or refitted. If one or more of the artifacts had moved around in the soils, this wouldn't be possible. Still, there have been criticisms of this study as well based on the lack of charcoal evidence, and Rachel Wood from the School of Earth Sciences at Australian National University argues that the lowest artifacts form the start boundary at 70.7 thousand years to 60 thousand years ago. This means that we can't say exactly when people first used the shelter, just that it happened between those dates. Other people, such as Joe Dorch, have argued that these occupation dates line up with the genetic evidence, which points towards a date of Aboriginal people arriving around 70,000 years ago. Now, at the start of the episode, I said that the sun was setting over Sahul sometime between 65 and 80,000 years ago. But if the dates are so solid for 65,000 years, why even include 80,000 years? In the very deepest levels of the excavation, there are artifacts in a layer that has a date of 79,000 plus or minus 4,000. This means that the artifacts could be as old as 83,000 years or as young as 75,000. But this is not a dense layer of occupation. You see, of the 11,000 artifacts recovered, 10,000 of them were recovered from a really dense artifact layer that has a date of 65,000 years ago. But there are artifacts below that date. The problem is that because there are so few artifacts in this very old date, there is a very small possibility that they have sunk in the soils over time. This would mean that the artifacts are in an older layer of soil than they actually should be, providing us with a false date. Now, Clarkson and his team argued that this is extremely unlikely because at 65,000 years ago, there's a very, very dense layer of occupation, so dense that more than 10,000 of the 11,000 artifacts were from this layer, where people were using the shelter for a long period of time, coming in and out, depositing cultural material, and importantly, compacting the earth to create a hard layer of soil that would prevent anything from moving downwards. The team has done a lot of testing and experimenting on these artifacts, and they say that there's only a 5% chance that these artifacts have moved downwards. However, there is still a 5% chance, and because of this, we can't rule out that this date is incorrect. And so, because of that, 65,000 years ago is the strongest, most provable, and most backed up date we have. It is worth noting, however, that the team really believes that these artifacts have not moved and that they are up to 80,000 years old, so I think I smell another dig coming. Either way, this is an extremely old site and it has a number of consequences. The first is that it validates and adds scientific knowledge to the Mara people's cultural knowledge about the length of time that their ancestors have lived in this part of Australia. It also turns two main theories about human movement in the past on its head. The first is the timeline for people leaving Africa. Even though this information was published 8 years ago, if you Google the Out of Africa migration right now, you'll still find maps, articles, and diagrams showing that people arrived in Australia 50,000 or sometimes even 40,000 years ago. With the firm date of occupation in Australia being established at 65,000 years ago, this means that people have to have left Africa much earlier than we thought in order to have made the journey through Asia and Southeast Asia to get to Australia. So this pushes back the timeline of when humans first left Africa, or it means that we expanded a lot faster than previously thought possible. But the latter isn't supported by the evidence. The second question that this raises is about the extinction of Australia's megafauna. As I mentioned earlier, the most recent date we have for megafauna is from 33 to 37,000 years ago. This would mean that the megafauna existed alongside the first Australians for at least 30,000 years before they went extinct. To me at least, it seems incredibly unlikely that the first Australians could be responsible for hunting megafauna to extinction if it took 30,000 years. Because of these implications, the focus on Marjabibi has always centered around its incredible antiquity, but one of the lesser discussed aspects of the site is that it also contains an extensive rock art assemblage of over 1,000 images. In fact, given how weathered and faded the paintings are today, researchers suggest that there were likely many times this number that flaked and faded from the shelter's walls over the many thousands of years of occupation. Most of these motifs are paintings in the traditional sense, where you would use wet paint and a brush or your hand to paint an image. But there are also a large variety of stencils, which is when you create a negative image of an object, such as spraying wet paint over your hand held up against the wall, as well as drawings created with crayon-like sticks of ochre and beeswax figures stuck to the walls. The colouring of the painting is also incredibly beautiful, with mostly red, yellow, and orange earthy ochre colours that are sparsely decorated by dark charcoals and brilliant white clay paintings. The types of designs present at Marjabibi are also varied and include human-like figures, geometric designs, hand stencils, a variety of identifiable fish species including catfish, barramundi, long tom, mullet and sardigo, objects made from plant fibres, and even paintings from the time of European contact including firearms, pipes, knives, ships, and European people wearing the typical clothing for the time and standing with their hands on their hips. Unfortunately, at the time of making this video, there is no absolute way to date rock art. Instead, estimates for the age of the visible arts suggest they were created in the last 1,500 years. However, you might recall that the team recovered ochre crayons and paint from their excavation in a layer dating to 65,000 years ago. Despite our current inability to directly date rock art, this shows that Aboriginal people have been painting this rock shelter for somewhere in the range of 2,500 generations. This sort of timescale is really difficult to wrap our minds around, but let me provide some context. The oldest evidence of farming is 400 generations old. The first cities in Mesopotamia were constructed 260 generations ago. The Declaration of Independence and the colonization of Australia by Europeans occurred just 9.5 generations ago. What this evidence shows is that for 2,500 generations, or more than 65,000 years, the first Australians have been coming to Marjit Bibi to hunt and to gather, to cook their bounties and for shelter from the elements. While they were here, they painted the walls using the earthy colours of ochre in order to express themselves and pass on the traditions and histories of their people so that their culture would live on through time. Those people are still there, still practicing their culture and traditions. In this region of Australia, they are known as the Mara people. But across the entire continent, you will find similar stories about the people who first came to this rugged and beautiful land, who became the first Australians. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Unearthing History. This episode was a little bit different. It was longer and it used a bit of a story at the start to try and help you picture what life was like back then and really highlight the achievements of these first people. If you enjoyed this style, I'd love to hear about it in the comments on either YouTube, Twitch, TikTok, or you can join my Discord for a proper chat. There's links to all that stuff in the show notes or the video description. I'd also like to announce that I'm going to Europe on the 14th of February and I won't be back until the 30th of March. This is a really long time, so rather than leave you guys with a content drought for 6 weeks, I'm going to be uploading some travel stuff because we're going to be visiting all of the incredible historical places in Europe, as well as Jordan and Cairo. I think this is a great opportunity to make some incredible historical content, and if you want to keep up with that, I'll be posting short videos daily on TikTok, but longer form travel videos will be up on my YouTube, so head over there and chuck that a sub. Once again, thank you for listening to Unearthing History. My name is Zane, and I'll see you on the next one.